This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, Wall Street awaits earnings from the big banks as well as minutes from the last Fed meeting. I'm Bob Moon in New York. I'll have that story.
I'm Nathan Hager in Washington, where South Korea's leader is headed this week looking to get North Korean nuclear talks back on track.
I'm Danielle Bokov in Toronto. Saudi Aramco makes more profit than Apple, Google, and Exxon combined, but that's not stopping it from tapping global debt markets for more.
And in Asia, India goes to the polls. What does it mean for the Indian economy? I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with a look at the health of the banking industry. On Friday, the first of the big banks will report quarterly earnings. And for more, we're joined by Allison Williams, Senior Financial Services Analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, and Bloomberg News investment banking reporter Shanala Basak. And let me start with you, Allison. What is the outlook for the banking industry overall?
Things were a little softer in certain areas, but also we're comparing to a really strong year-ago quarter. So we're expecting declines in both trading revenues, banking fees. However, what's going to be more important is what is the outlook coming into this next quarter. We did sort of see a couple of signs of optimism at the end of the quarter, volatility picking up, comments from Jefferies on how March looked a little bit better. And, you know, part of the reason why we're seeing weak fees in the first quarter was the government shutdown. So some of that volume getting pushed out, could some of that show up in 2Q?
Shanala, volatility is really key for the investment sector, right?
It is. And, you know, there's sometimes there's good volatility and sometimes there's bad volatility. When the markets are too shaky, nobody wants to do anything. And it's really hard to figure out what deals done to get done at what prices. And you know, trading ends up freezing up. And so people are really going to want an outlook on whether this volatility moving forward. Jamie Dimon has said sustained volatility. Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
And when we talk about volatility, a lot of that lately is in jobs, is it not, Allison?
We have seen a few announcements, and I think that's something we're going to want to definitely hear more about the quarter. Are these announcements just the typical culling? Investment banks do turn over a certain amount of staff every year, and sometimes when the year gets off to a weaker start, those cuts happen earlier in the year. So some of these announcements that we've seen, is that just sort of the normal process, or is there something more going on beneath the surface? At Goldman, we've had a senior management change. We know that they're looking at the business. They've said that. So are there certain things going on between the underneath the surface? Their commodity business is something that's been talked about. JP Morgan's another company where there's been talk in the asset management business. So asset management, which was stable for several years coming out of the crisis while investment banks were doing a lot of cuts, we've seen sort of more aggressiveness in that business just after a tough year last year. There's a lot of different pressures in different business lines. Are the cuts at JP Morgan, again, just part of the normal process, or is there something more strategic going on? Technology's playing an increasing role, the move to passive. Is there something more happening there?
Shanala, on Friday, one of the banks we get is JPM. How have they been doing?
So out of all the banks, they're one of the more stable ones. I cover European banks as well, and we're seeing poor performance pretty much all over the world. They have said over and over that they're kind of in growth mode. They're opening branches all over the place. You know, now interest rate expectations are lower, so I want to see how that's going to impact them moving forward. Jamie Dimon has gotten more cautious on the global environment in general. So the expectation moving forward for that bank, both on what they're going to make on loans and how risky they think the markets are right now, we'll say something not just for JP Morgan, but I think the banking sector at large.
Allison, I save the best, and I say that advisedly for you. We've got Wells Fargo earnings coming up on Friday as well.
And obviously the biggest question for Wells Fargo is who is going to lead the bank. And we're not going to get probably much insight into that this quarter. So there might be questions around it to the interim CEO.
That's an understatement.
But really, the question is who's going to lead the bank? What kind of changes are going to be brought? Of course, there's the issue of the asset cap. And does this change accelerate things or does it delay things? One would think that this was probably part of a move to expedite things on that front. just given, and especially given some of the comments that we heard from regulators in the past quarter. So strategically, Wells Fargo, that's a big question. You know, the other issue, the sort of lingering day-to-day impacts of their business. And then also on the legal front, Goldman Sachs, which we'll hear from actually the following Monday, what's going on with their legal risk. So 1MDB is sort of the lingering issue for them. So both of these companies, sort of things going on strategically, Wells looking for a new CEO, Goldman has a new CEO, but then looking, so what are sort of the past issues and what kind of pain is that going to bring?
So with all those question marks out there about interest rates, about jobs and other things, Allison, is this a scary time for investors to be looking at the banking industry?
Well, the word scary, I guess, is it's all relative, right? Like, mm-hmm. So it's certainly not, you know, there are more concerns about a recession, but certainly not to the depths that we saw in the previous financial crisis. Just when we think about sort of the buildup going into that crisis, you know, obviously a recession is going to come at some point, but the banks are much better capitalized. They've reduced risk, so there's sort of a lot of protections in place. But there, we are going to be looking for clues in terms of how the macros are impacting the bank. So interest margins is something that investors are a little bit more worried about. Credit, expect that will still continue to be stellar. In fact, we might see reserve releases still at companies like Bank America and Wells Fargo. And then loan growth. We actually expect some pretty good loan growth from the bank. And I think, again, we're going to be looking strategically who's doing better or worse in terms of gaining market share.
Our thanks to Allison Williams, Senior Financial Services Analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, and Bloomberg News Investment Banking Reporter Shanali Basik. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, we preview the IMF and World Bank Spring Meetings in Washington. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, Wall Street awaits earnings from the big banks as well as minutes from the last Fed meeting. I'm Bob Moon in New York. I'll have that story.
I'm Nathan Hager in Washington, where South Korea's leader is headed this week looking to get North Korean nuclear talks back on track.
I'm Danielle Bokov in Toronto. Saudi Aramco makes more profit than Apple, Google, and Exxon combined, but that's not stopping it from tapping global debt markets for more.
And in Asia, India goes to the polls. What does it mean for the Indian economy? I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with a look at the health of the banking industry. On Friday, the first of the big banks will report quarterly earnings. And for more, we're joined by Allison Williams, Senior Financial Services Analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, and Bloomberg News Investment Banking Reporter Shanali Basik. And let me start with you, Allison. What is the outlook for the banking industry overall?
Things were a little softer in certain areas, but also we're comparing to a really strong year-ago quarter. So we're expecting declines in both trading revenues, banking fees. However, what's going to be more important is what is the outlook coming into this next quarter? We did sort of see a couple of signs of optimism at the end of the quarter, volatility picking up, comments from Jefferies on how March looked a little bit better. And, you know, part of the reason why we're seeing weak fees in the first quarter was the government shutdown. So some of that volume getting pushed out, could some of that show up in 2Q?
Shanali, volatility is really key for the investment sector, right?
It is. And, you know, sometimes there's good volatility and sometimes there's bad volatility. When the markets are too shaky, nobody wants to do anything. And it's really hard to figure out what deals done to get done at what prices. And you know, trading ends up freezing up. And so people are really going to want an outlook on whether this volatility moving forward. Jamie Dimon has said sustained volatility. Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
And when we talk about volatility, a lot of that lately is in jobs, is it not, Allison?
We have seen a few announcements, and I think that's something we're going to want to definitely hear more about the quarter. are these announcements just the typical culling? You know, investment banks do turn over a certain amount of staff every year. And sometimes when the year gets off to a weaker start, those cuts happen earlier in the year. So some of these announcements that we've seen, is that just sort of the normal process, or is there something more going on beneath the surface? At Goldman, we've had a senior management change. We know that they're looking at the business. They've said that. So are there certain things going on between the underneath the surface? Their commodity business is something that's been talked about. JP Morgan's another company where there's been talk in the asset management business. So asset management, which was stable for several years coming out of the crisis while investment banks were doing a lot of cuts, we've seen sort of more aggressiveness in that business just after a tough year last year. There's a lot of different pressures in different business lines. Are the cuts at JP Morgan, again, just part of the normal process, or is there something more strategic going on? Technologies playing an increasing role, the move to passive. Is there something more happening there?
Shanali, on Friday, one of the banks we get is JPM. How have they been doing?
So out of all the banks, they're one of the more stable ones. I cover European banks as well, and we're seeing poor performance pretty much all over the world. You know, they have said over and over that they're kind of in growth mode. They're opening branches all over the place. You know, now interest rate expectations are lower, so I want to see how that's going to impact them moving forward. Jamie Dimon has gotten more cautious on the global environment in general. So the expectation moving forward for that bank, both on what they're going to make on loans and how risky they think the markets are right now, will say something not just for JP Morgan, but I think the banking sector at large.
Allison, I saved the best, and I say that advisedly for you. We've got Wells Fargo earnings coming up on Friday as well.
And obviously the biggest question for Wells Fargo is who is going to lead the bank. And we're not going to get probably much insight into that this quarter. So there might be questions around it to the interim CEO.
That's an understatement.
But really, you know, the question is who's going to lead the bank? What kind of changes are going to be brought? Of course, there's the issue of the asset cap. And does this change accelerate things, or does it delay things? One would think that this was probably part of a move to expedite things on that front. And especially given some of the comments that we heard from regulators in the past quarter. So strategically, Wells Fargo, that's a big question. You know, the other issue, the sort of lingering day-to-day impacts of their business. And then also on the legal front, Goldman Sachs, which we'll hear from actually the following Monday, what's going on with their legal risk. So 1MDB is sort of the lingering issue for them. So both of these companies, sort of things going on strategically, Wells looking for a new CEO, Goldman has a new CEO, but then looking, so what are sort of the past issues and what kind of pain is that going to bring?
So with all those question marks out there about interest rates, about jobs and other things, Allison, is this a scary time for investors to be looking at the banking industry?
Well, the word scary, I guess, it's all relative, right? Like, mm-hmm. So it's certainly not, you know, there are more concerns about a recession, but certainly not to the depths that we saw in the previous financial crisis, just when we think about sort of the buildup going into that crisis. You know, obviously a recession is going to come at some point, but the banks are much better capitalized. They've reduced risk, so there's sort of a lot of protections in place. But there, we are going to be looking for clues in terms of how the macros are impacting the bank. So interest margins is something that investors are a little bit more worried about. Credit, expect that will still continue to be stellar. In fact, we might see reserve releases still at companies like Bank America and Wells Fargo. And then loan growth. We actually expect some pretty good loan growth from the bank. And I think, again, we're going to be looking strategically who's doing better or worse in terms of gaining market share.
Our thanks to Allison Williams, Senior Financial Services Analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, and Bloomberg News Investment Banking Reporter Shanali Basak. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, we preview the IMF and World Bank Spring Meetings in Washington. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm Bob Moon in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. Time to head to London, where we're looking ahead to the European Central Bank's rate decision and press conference on Wednesday. Investor focus will be on Mario Draghi's commentary surrounding slowing growth in the Eurozone. We get more from Daybreak Europe anchor Neyra Chayich.
Bob, the clouds over the euro area have darkened since the European Central Bank last met. At that meeting, the Governing Council downgraded its growth and inflation forecasts, announced a new TLTRO III program of bank loans, and signalled no hikes for 2019. So what can we expect this week? For more, we can turn to David Powell, senior euro area economist for Bloomberg Economics. But first, let's bring in Bloomberg's ECB reporter in Frankfurt, Carolyn Look. Carolyn, great to have you with us. You're always there asking fantastic questions to Mario Draghi in the news conference. What are you going to be looking out for in the news conference this time?
Hi there. Yeah, so I mean, it was only last March that the Governing Council announced their long-term loans for banks. So I don't think we're going to get any major new stimulus announcements this time. But what we've heard from policymakers since the last meeting is that what they want to see is how lending conditions evolve amid this, as you noted, you know, very gloomy economic outlook that we have in the euro area. So a lot of the terms for the TLTROs haven't been announced yet. And between now and, let's say, you know, June, July, the ECB is going to want to clarify how generous they want to be in order to help banks increase their lending to the economy.
Yes, and the TLTRO III got a lot of attention out of the last meeting, David. When are you expecting more details to be announced, and what do you expect them to be?
Well, as Carolyn said, we actually don't have a clear idea when exactly that will come. At a speech in Frankfurt just last week, Mario Draghi hinted that banks may be getting help. That suggests the announcement may be imminent. On the other hand, the following day, Bloomberg News conducted an interview with the ECB chief economist, Peter Pratt, and he suggested that June would be a more likely moment for those details to come. So given that, June is probably the most likely date, but we certainly can't rule out something coming this month in terms of more details. And what exactly there'll be is probably further detail on the interest rate that will be charged. So last time, these loans were tied to the main refinancing rate, which is currently at zero. But the interest rate could have been as low as the deposit rate, which is negative 40 basis points based on how much a bank lends. This time they've said once again the loans will be tied to that main refinancing rate of zero. And they also said there would be incentives for additional lending, but they didn't tell us what exactly those incentives were. So if they want to be as generous as they were last time, those incentives would be, depending on how much a bank lends, once again, yep, that rate could be as low as the deposit rate.
Look, and Carolyn, this comes back to the discussion about the impact of negative rates in the Eurozone. What are we hearing from various policymakers on this at the moment?
Basically, the ECB's deposit facility has a negative interest rate, as you said, and banks in the region have repeatedly complained that this is placing a drag on profitability. So how much that is actually, you know, the major drag on profits is certainly debatable, and the ECB has said as much. But what they've highlighted is that there is a risk that it could hamper their ability to transmit their very easy monetary policy stance to the economy going forward. So Draghi was talking about the fact that the ECB stands ready to look into ways to mitigate that impact. And Peter Pratt, in his interview with us later, said that you know, ECB staff were indeed studying options, but that no decision had been made. So that's certainly something that they will be quizzed on at the press conference.
Let's talk a bit more about tiering, David. How far could that go in actually offsetting the impact of negative rates on banks?
Well, that would offer euro area banks even more relief than a lower interest rate on the TLTROs. Essentially, where we are right now in the euro area is that money markets have been flooded with liquidity as a result of the ECB's asset purchases. And that extra liquidity ends up parked at the ECB after it's deposited at banks. And the banks have to pay an interest rate on those excess reserves because the deposit rate is negative. In normal times, the ECB would pay them to park reserves there, but because the interest rate is negative, they actually have to pay the ECB to park money there. And so that's costing banks a lot of money to park all of that cash at the ECB. And what the ECB could do is it could come up with a system where different tranches of reserve have different interest rates, and that would cost the banks less money. They wouldn't have to pay the ECB to park that money at the ECB.
David Powell, senior euro area economist for Bloomberg Economics and Bloomberg's ECB reporter in Frankfurt, Carolyn Look, thank you both. I'm Neera Chahich in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thank you, Neera. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, a look at what's on the agenda in our nation's capital. And we also head to Asia, where India is gearing up for national elections. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Time to head to the nation's capital to look at what's on the agenda this week. Bloomberg Daybreak anchor Nathan Hager joins us from Washington with more. Nathan.
Well, Bob, the North Korea nuclear threat could be back on the front burner in Washington this week. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is scheduled to meet with President Trump at the White House on Thursday to try to get negotiations back on track. Bloomberg White House team leader Alex Wayne is here with me now. And, of course, Alex, this comes after the famous walkaway by President Trump during the Hanoi summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. So what are the expectations heading into this meeting with the South Korean leader Thursday?
Well, two unpopular presidents getting together to talk about an intractable problem. Both of these men are under pressure to show some progress with North Korea. Like you said, the president walked out of his Hanoi summit because he thought the North Koreans were asking for too much. They demanded, according to the president, that all U.S. sanctions be dropped in exchange for dismantling their main nuclear site. The U.S. has insisted that that the North Koreans have to give up their entire weapons program before sanctions are removed. So we're now at kind of a loggerheads with the North Koreans. There hasn't been any progress since Hanoi. The North Koreans have apparently refused to initiate new talks. They've been saying mean things about Moon's administration, and Moon in South Korea is under pressure from his citizens to show some progress in these talks himself.
Now, you talk about these two leaders being under pressure. Of course, the watchword from the Trump administration has been maximum pressure on North Korea. Is that still the policy? And I ask that because there's been, some confusion since after the Hanoi summit about whether maximum sanctions were going to be imposed on North Korea and other nations accused of helping that country skirt sanctions.
Yeah, there was a very strange incident late last month where the U.S. Issued sanctions against a couple of Chinese shipping companies that were helping North Korea evade trade restrictions. The president the next day tweeted that there weren't going to be any more large-scale sanctions in North Korea. We were just going to keep things status quo. It was unclear for several hours what he was talking about. Turned out that he intended to withdraw the sanctions against the Chinese shipping companies, but his staff managed to walk him back on that, realizing that it would cause problems with U.S. sanctions policy.
Does the president himself, the U.S. president, feel himself to be under pressure at this point? I mean, he's said that he's not under any rush to come to a final agreement with North Korea on denuclearization.
I think maybe he doesn't. He has, like you said, he has said this can take some time. And right now, North Korea is no longer testing nuclear weapons or missiles. And so that is an accomplishment for the president. He has ratcheted down the tension between the U.S. and North Korea. I think he deserves some credit for that. We're in a different place than we were in the first year of his presidency when it was all fire and fury and little Rocket Man. And it looked like the two countries were headed for war.
Well, this meeting will be one to watch. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
That's Bloomberg White House team leader Alex Wayne, and that is what's happening in the nation's capital. I'm Nathan Hager. Follow all developments in Washington by tuning into Bloomberg Politics, Policy, Power, and Law. It airs weekdays at noon Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. Bob.
Thank you, Nathan. Now let's head over to Asia, where India is gearing up for national elections.
For more, let's turn things over to our Daybreak Asia team, Doug Krisner in New York and Brian Curtis in Hong Kong.
Bob, how popular is Prime Minister Narendra Modi in India? Well, we'll soon find out. India goes to the polls starting April 11th, with the elections running through May 19th.
And voters will be electing their representatives to India's lower house of parliament, the Lok Sabha, that is the House of the People. So Brian and I thought we'd take a look at how the economy might affect the outcome of the election and what changes might be coming soon on both fiscal and monetary policy.
And our guest is Bloomberg reporter Anirban Nag. Anirban, the Prime Minister is a kind of divisive figure. It seems like you either love him or you don't. Why?
You're absolutely right about that. The reason is that he is a center-right guy who kind of depends on the Hindu majority for his votes. The other reason is that having promised about 10 million jobs in 2014 to the youth of India, he hasn't delivered on that. So there is a political compulsion given that the economy has been held back by cooling investments, falling consumption, and a global slowdown. We will see Mr. Modi hark back to what he knows the best, depending upon the Hindu majority to get his vote and get him past the majority mark.
Is there more of a unified effort being made to try to address the lack of employment opportunities and to get the economy going?
Absolutely, that's right. The problem with this is that these are only short-term palliatives that that the government and the RBI is putting in place. You've got to see India has a huge banking sector crisis. It has one of the biggest stressed asset ratios in the world. Now, what the previous government wanted to do is actually address that by sequestering the weak banks, not allowing them to lend. Of course, he lost his job, he resigned, and he's gone. The new governor has dismantled all those harsh rules that were in place for banks and allow these banks, weak banks, especially state-run banks, to lend again. So what that's expected to do is expected to boost credit growth, it's expected to boost lending. Hopefully companies will invest and that will create jobs.
So imagine a world where Modi wins the election, but he struggles when it comes to his party and state elections. Would that mean kind of poor results for investors going forward?
Look, it's a very strange country in India. Unlike the West, where you have the center-right having a different kind of fiscal policy and a center-left having a different kind of policy, here both the center-right as well as the opposition Congress have almost the same welfare policies in place, which means they want to widen the fiscal deficit, they want to spend more with the budget, and the budget is constrained through lower taxation. India's direct tax to GDP ratio is stuck at 2% for God knows how many decades. So that's a big, big problem. So the fiscal deficit, both of them are actually promising a lot, especially through basic income transfer. The Congress party is looking at $52 billion income plan. The BJP, too, has billions of dollars lined up for this, which has already been given shape. So both these parties are looking at actually digging deep into the budget, throwing the fiscal deficit that has been very tight in the past few years.
Yeah.
Into a little bit of a shamble.
Okay, Anirban, thanks so much for joining us. Our guest, Bloomberg reporter Anirban Nag. I'm Brian Curtis here in Hong Kong, along with Doug Krisner in New York. You can catch us every weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 7 a.m. in Hong Kong and 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob?
Thanks, Doug and Brian. Let's head to the commodity space now for the week ahead. The largest oil company in the world is knocking on bond investors' doors as it plans to raise billions in the global debt market. Bloomberg's Danielle Bokove has more from Toronto. Danielle.
Bob, the Saudi Arabian oil company launched a string of roadshows around the world this week to market what could be a $10 billion bond issuance. Bloomberg's Javier Blas has been covering the story, and he joins me from London. It's nice to speak to you.
Nice to talk to you, Danielle.
This is a company that produces more profit than Apple, Google, and Exxon combined, and yet it has been very opaque until now. We've really pulled the curtain back with this bond issuance. What have you learned, Javier?
Well, it's the first time that we know anything about the financials of Saudi Aramco in 40 years since the company was nationalized in the late 1970s. The big number that we learned this week is the net income, $111 billion last year in net income. You need to combine the five largest oil companies, that's the likes of Exxon, BP, Shell, Chevron, Total, and you will not get to that number. We also learn other details, like, for example, Aramco can produce oil out of the Saudi desert for just $3 a barrel. And oil today is trading around $60 a barrel. So just imagine the profit that the company can make. And they have no debt whatsoever.
And clearly they don't need to go to the debt market given how profitable they are. So why are they now?
Well, the government wants that the company takes transparency steps, and this is one way to take transparency steps. The government, or the Saudi government, also wants that the company becomes more acquaintance with the international base, with investors. And that's this is a baby step towards becoming more transparent towards Wall Street, because Saudi Arabia at one point would like to do an initial public offering of Aramco. So this is a preliminary stage in that potential path towards an IPO, but certainly they could have used their own cash to finance the acquisitions that they want to do. The most immediate one is they are buying a significant stake, a 70% stake, in a local petrochemical company named SABIC for about $70 billion.
And of course, that is part of the government's sort of push to diversify its economy a little bit. So there's a lot riding on this, I guess, in broader terms. What are the main risks for this company?
Well, the risk chapter was very long in the prospectus, and we learned what you will expect when a company in the Middle East is announcing a deal. The Middle East is a place of unrest, of wars. The prospectus talks about even missiles flying over some facilities in Aramco. But the big risk for investors is climate change. If you are investing in oil, the risk of climate change is very important. We also learned, for example, that Ghawar, which is the world's conventional largest oil field, is not producing as much as we thought. This is the center of the riches of Saudi Arabia. And the conventional wisdom in the market was that the field was producing north of 5 million barrels a day. In reality, it's producing 3.8 million barrels a day. So it means that it's in decline. And that is big news for the market. And it has been a hot topic for the petroleum engineering community.
Javier, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That's what we're watching this week in Commodities in Toronto. I'm Danielle Bogov. Bob.
Thanks, Danielle. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.